Test, test. All right, welcome to the lecture number two in data science for security and forensics. Today we're going to talk about data in general. So what's data? What are the characteristics, like, for example, difference between different types of features, how we're going to use features, building a model. What is actually a model? It's basically fitting an algorithm to some kind of data. And then we're going to talk about performance evaluation. So what kind of metrics, what kind of measures we can use to check how good is the machine learning method, and whether there are any differences between, for example, two methods with different parameters. A few administrative announcements. So we're now on the lecture two. It's Kononenko chapters 3 and 4 and CEO chapter 2. So machine learning basics and knowledge representation. So for the semester, you've heard already this plan, but I'll just want to repeat a few items. So we're going to have 7 lectures and 7 exercises tutorials. You're more than welcome to send us email if something is not clear. So just don't wait until the exam. Please come to us or talk to us if something is not clear. Written examination currently is 8th of June 2023. It's 3 hours examination. Please check Anthony web page for the latest update. So normally it doesn't change, but just in case, so that you know what's the exam date. So as you heard already, it's 4 assignments, so 40% of the grade, and 60% of the grade will be exam, so written exam, on-campus written exam. All the material that you hear in the lectures that we have in the chapters of the book that are recommended for reading, those will be on the exam. So please follow the lectures, do the tutorials, exercises, and submit assignments so that in the end you get the necessary grade. So the exam will contain open questions, so will not ask you to calculate something like, for example, average or mean. Of course, this is rather trivial, but it will be more about understanding of machine learning and understanding of the models, features, how to use them, what's the difference between, for example, k-means and artificial neural network, how to apply them in practice, how to prepare the data, how to use the data, and how to apply those in a real-world scenario. So how many of you already read this book or started reading? All right. So I still can recommend to get this book either in the library or in the bookstore, or I think that there is a PDF available somewhere. So I think you can find also like electronic copy of this book online. That's the second book. It's much easier to get. You just need to check the URL. It's a very nice book, a lot of exercises and practice when it comes to application of machine learning using Python, so you can repeat and program everything in Python, and it's basically a huge variety of libraries that you can use for machine learning. How many of you know what is Keras or TensorFlow, maybe used it? All right. So it's just an example of de facto standard machine learning libraries for, you know, things like neural networks, deep learning, and they're quite useful. So in some of the lectures, I'm going to show you how to use like Vekka RapidMiner. Those are rather, let's say, trivial tools if you want to play with the data. If you want to make more complex model and tasks, you need to use Keras or TensorFlow. They also optimize for things like Internet of Things, you know, Raspberry Pi, so you can run those modules already on smaller controllers. All right, reference group. So we need three members. That's the on-campus full-time student, experience-based, and remote student. So that's part of the quality assurance framework at the faculty and NTNU in general, to serve, let's say, as a contact point between students and teaching staff, to see that we, let's say, have all the learning outcomes in place, teaching format, and so on, and to give us constructive feedback if anything has to be changed. So please reach out to Kyle or myself, and we'll announce the reference group composition after 16th of February. All right, I'm going to change the slides. So, knowledge representation. I mean, in general, the data is some kind of abstraction that gives us understanding. For example, the weather, temperature changes, humidity changes. That's the knowledge about the weather, right? So we have kind of understanding what's happening. If it's, for example, morning, if it's daytime, if it's evening. So in this course, you will see different types of and different levels of data representation. So it can be as simple as just a phrase. We say that, for example, it's warm in the daytime and cold in the night. It can be just a plot, like a visualization. That's also a data representation. Visualization is something that is very valuable because you can have a 100 gigabytes data set that you can compress into a small 2D plot that represents all the features of the data and correlation, for example. So that's technically something that you can utilize. So knowledge representation is a field of artificial intelligence. You're also going to read about this field in Kononenko. And this field gives us a different, let's say, view on the data and, let's say, data abstraction. So we can have the same data represented in a different format. Like, for example, think about a file stored on the hard drive, right? We can represent it as a series of 010101. We can represent it as a hexadecimal. We can represent it as, for example, text. So that's what it means to have a data representation. Because normally when we talk about raw data, this is not exactly understandable. So we can't really get, we can't grasp when it comes to big data. If we have 100 gigabytes, we need to open the file, we need to read through the file, so it's too much. Data representation helps us to understand, and it's all types of also descriptive statistics. So, minimum, maximum, average, so everything that can be used and to represent the data. So when it comes to machine learning and data science in general, you will hear a lot different terminology. So attributes, features, characteristics, it's all types of, variables that we can describe some kind of process like temperature, humidity. We have a variable, right, like in programming. And that's the idea of having a different attributes or different features. Like if you want to classify cats and dogs, the features that we can utilize, number of ears and number of eyes, even though they are not representative because both animals, they have the same number of ears and eyes. Just a small example. So normally we have the attributes. So it can be one or multiple attributes. When it comes to, for example, computer viruses analysis, you can utilize different types of attributes like size of file. It can be number of import functions in the import table. It can be size of P header, portable executable header. And so on. So that's an example of attributes. They also can have different types of values, like, for example, discrete, So it can be discrete attributes, it can be also continuous attributes. Like temperature, this is rather continuous attribute, like 1.7, 2.9, and so on. When it comes to discrete attributes, these can be, for example, number of functions in the import table, right? So this is discrete, 1, 2, 3, 10, hundreds. And the output attribute that normally we call C, this is something that defines the class. So this notion of, let's say, prediction or the label or the output attribute will be used in the classification. Like if you want to classify again cats and dogs, class number one will be a cat and class number two will be a dog. So that's the difference between these types of output attributes. There are a lot of problems that you may encounter while working with attributes and features. Like, you know, it can be missing attributes. It can be all types of, you know, redundant attributes when they correlate it. It can be noisy attributes. It can be random attributes. It can be a lot of mistakes or faulty values. Like if we have temperature, you know, you might get temperature of air in Jovik, like between minus 25 to plus 35, but then suddenly you see a value of plus 1,000 centigrades. This is too much. So it means that we probably have some kind of error in the data set. Of course, we also have a basic logical descriptors that we can use to define, let's say, relationship between the data. So normally, let's say, if we have different types of objects, we can have some kind of connection. Like, for example, a bottle is standing on the table, so there is a relationship between the bottle and a table, so it's a very close relationship. If you try to connect this bottle to sun, then probably there will be less obvious relationship or correlation. So that's all types of relationship. Like, for example, every skier likes the snow. All brothers are siblings. So it's kind of a logical connections that are explicit, that we can see clearly. So there can be also different types of, let's say, logical order of attributes. So we can have, for example, two, three, four, five objects. Like here we have a person that is a brother to another person, person king. A person king has a crown on the head and so on. So that's basically, you know, the a basic knowledge database. So we have kind of relationship between the different type of attributes and objects. Now, for the knowledge representation, we also going to use DIKW pyramid. So that's a representation of a knowledge, right? So we have data, which is trivial information, something like, for example, temperature, humidity. Then we have the information, like, for example, we can put it in the context, like we have some kind of day change and so on. Then from the information, we can put knowledge that, you know, we can see seasonal trends like autumn, spring, summer, winter. But also we can, you know, extract a wisdom. So it's usually high-level information or abstraction. Where we have the understanding how, you know, temperature changes in the whole world, how it's, let's say, correlated to any kind of events, like global warming, for example, and so on. So that's the understanding of the data. So the low-level data, and then we have a high-level abstraction or wisdom. First example, we have experimental results. So let's assume we have X and Y, and we do some kind of measurement, so just abstract or arbitrary variables. So raw data, we can't really see any patterns in the raw data because it's just a tabular format of the data. We need to do some pre-processing to understand. So as I mentioned, visualization is one of the powerful tools that you're going to use in this course and also later. And it gives us understanding that there is actually a strong correlation between the data. So, for example, up until X is equal to nearly 2, we have the increase or positive correlation. So X is increasing, Y is increasing. And after nearly 2 or 1.9, we have X increasing, but Y will be decreasing. So we can see clearly that there is two distinct regions. And then we can also involve human expert to interpret it, so we can actually build linguistic rules that can be read and understood by human experts. Like if X is low, then Y is low, for example, and so on. Another example, if we have a network traffic and we want to build a detection of network attacks. Let's assume we understand what's the raw packet data, the structure of the network packet, you know, what kind of fields there and so on. After analysis, we can extract the information. So we can clearly, for example, recognize that this is a DDoS attack, a lot of similar traffic, dummy data, nothing inside of the packet. And then we have the normal traffic from the users. So something that has meaningful information or meaningful data. After interpretation, we can design, or we can think of, let's say, recognition of whether it's intrusion going on, a high level, like what kind of what type of attack, like a Neptune DDoS attack, or it's a normal traffic that comes from the accounting or HR department, so we can kind of put it in the context. And then finally, we get the IDS policy. So we get this wisdom how to detect and protect the infrastructure inside the network from, let's say, malicious traffic or from DDoS attacks. So knowledge representation is about using different methods and models to represent the data in a more understandable, human understandable format. It can be visualization, it can be different degrees of logic, regression, it can be all types of mapping functions. So we're going to learn a little bit more about mapping, how we can use, for example, different types of mapping to map the function, map like one type of data to another type of data. For example, adding some kind of features or adding some kind of context so that it's more understandable. Now, do we have any questions? All right, I'm going to change the slides. You can also ask questions in Zoom, so in the chat, and I can answer those. Let's see. So machine learning basics, I'm going to explain in details what are features, what are attributes, how they're used and how they integrated in the model, the feature space. And then we're going to talk about what is the machine learning model actually. It is like, for example, we have the algorithm, we have the data, how we construct this model. So what's the meaning of this model and how we can deploy it? Because in general, you will hear machine learning model, machine learning method, machine learning algorithm, and so on. So algorithm is like a cooking recipe. It's just a set of, let's say, steps that you need to perform in order to train the data. And then the model is the result of this training. So it's something that comes out and something that you can apply and use in real world scenario, for example. Then the module selection, performance testing, like how do we compare different types of models when it comes to classification, when it comes to things like regression. And then I'm going to talk about curves of dimensionality. Right, so as you know, data is all around us. We're living in a data-driven, let's say, world where everything is based on data. I mean, there is no point of having a high-performance computer if we don't have any data that we are processing with such computers. So that's no point. So sometimes it's too much data around us and too much data that can define us, characterize us. So we don't really know, like, what's the, you know, what's out there. You know, at some point, when it comes to privacy, there are a lot of issues. Because, for example, the different platform companies like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, they have too much information. And everything is being stored in the cloud, somehow aggregated, transformed, analyzed, and used to do some marketing. As you also know, we have analog and digital. So when it comes to computers, everything is digital. Like we can record our voice and then use analog to digital converter, ADC, to store the voice in MP3 file, or we can do vice versa and play the MP3 file to get the data out in the analog format. So that's the transition when it comes to you know, transition, for example, from analog to digital in the digital forensics cases. We have a crime scene, and at some point we can utilize a different 3D scanners and, let's say, photo mechanisms to recreate this scene in the digital format. So it will be a 3D scene kind of a crime. Have you seen this picture before? It's a very nice picture that represents amount of information that can be stored on CD-ROM. So I think it was taken in mid-90s, if I'm not mistaken. Do you know the guy? So that's Bill Gates. And then the point of this picture was to represent that, you know, when moving to digital realm, we can save so much space and we can do things more efficiently. So that's amount of text that can be printed on normal A4 pages, and I think it was like 20 or 30 meters that can be stored in the digital format on normal CD-ROM. How many of you use at home like DVD-ROM or Blu-ray? So it's kind of getting outdated already. Everything in the cloud naturally, like you can transfer the files. You don't really need a, like, intermediate physical media. Right. So the data represents different types of features. As I mentioned, features, characteristics, attributes. It's something that defines the objects that we want to study or the data that we want to put in the machine learning model. So it's all about, you know, different types of attributes, like a trivial one that normally you can see out there is lens with temperature, humidity, so all types of attributes that usually have some kind of units, like lens width, it's usually centimeters or meters, duration, time, and so on. So technically it's all about these variables that we can integrate. The data types that you may also find in the machine learning applications, it can be either qualitative, like categorical values, so natural order like ABC, low, medium, high, and so on, or it can be just natural order or nominal, so we don't have any kind of way to order it, like languages, English, French, German. It can be colors, yellow, blue, and so on. So that's called nominal. Quantitative, or numerical attributes. So we have either discrete, so like number of functions in the import table in the P32 file, or it can be measurable, continuous, so temperature, 1.7, 2.9, and so on. Now, I have to mention here that in most of the cases when you're going to use machine learning models with all these types of attributes, it will be all transferred to the numerical attributes. So even if you have something like ordinal value, like, for example, high, medium, low, so anyway, at the lowest point of data processing, it will be transferred to, like, 3, medium 2, and low 1. So in some of the cases, like, for example, Weka, if you're going to use Weka, in Weka, it's automated mapping. So you don't need to, like, change, and you don't need to kind of, like, replace these values. Everything will be done automatically, independently from what kind of attributes you're using. So first of all, the tool is analyzing nature of the attributes, if it's a numerical, discrete, continuous, and then it looks if it's, for example, nominal attribute like text. And then while training a neural network, it will be transferred to 1, 2, 3, 4, or 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. So that's the whole idea that, you know, it's a machine learning, and it handles the data. But the data that we have from, let's say, our problem that we're trying to solve can be any type. So that's the advantage of this data processing and knowledge representation. So as you will see in Weka, it's quite easy to process the data, you know, to represent data in the tabular format, to store it also in the tabular format in different types, file types, like, for example, CSV, ARFF, and so on. But in real world data, it's not always the case because it's so much variety, variability, and different types of file formats, different types of data, errors, mistakes, faults in the data. So it's all added up into, let's say, real world data processing problem when you need to do some assumptions. You need to filter out data. You need to remove empty cells, for example, from the data set, and so on. So it's way more complex when you will be handling the real-world data. An example, if you are going to work with computer viruses, and let's assume you design experiment when you have hundreds of benign files, like Windows executables, and hundreds of worms or Trojan horses, and then you want to do first static analysis and second dynamic analysis. So static analysis, I assume, will be fine. You'll get all the nice data, all the numbers in place. But when you start doing the dynamic analysis, most likely you'll get some errors, kernel panic, so all types of, you know, dependency that this type of virus or software might ask for. So this will be real world data. So then you need to think like how to filter it, how to replace missing attributes, missing features, and what to do with some kind of data that is abnormal. Of course, as I mentioned, it's too much data around us. It's all getting, let's say, enhanced and aggregated nowadays. Like when it comes to cybersecurity, as you know, we have so many different platforms. Like, how many of you used VirusTotal? So that's a fantastic platform. I mean, it was designed as a more like computer viruses analysis platform, but nowadays you also have some, you know, cyber threats there and correlation to like different malware campaign, different types of applications. So everything can be aggregated. So if you analyze a file, most likely you'll get some information already available in the internet on different platforms. So that's a nice thing about cybersecurity nowadays, because you can Google, you can extract a lot of information from the internet. One of the examples that I have been working is analysis of computer viruses, and that's at some point we had 13 terabytes of viruses. So it's so difficult to process like in the conventional way, especially if you want to build machine learning models. It will be impossible. So you need to reduce the size of the data set. You need to process. You need to remove, for example, some files that cannot be run. And then you need to also enhance the quality. So if you have a quite bad quality data, machine learning model that you trained won't work. So that's the consideration that you need to keep in mind. If you want to try, you know, processing some large-scale data set or just interesting data sets, there are a lot of resources like Kaggle. Have you heard about Kaggle? It's a fantastic platform that I think they opened it like 8-10 years ago, where a company, for example, can publish a data set and give a task to anyone. Like, we want to classify, I don't know, cat and a dog based on 100 animals, and please suggest a best machine learning model that can give the best accuracy. So at some point they also mentioned that there will be a reward, for example, I don't know, €1,000. And became a very popular concept. So there are a lot of competitions, there are a lot of companies. You can also get access to this data for free. So if you want to practice a little bit, if you want to explore things, so please feel free to get the data. Things like, for example, human faces data set. So that's an example. If you will be working with I don't know, biometrics, for example, we have a biometrics laboratory here in the faculty. And if you're interested in faces recognition, iris recognition, fingerprints recognition, this is where machine learning is applied heavily. So you also can have a look at this data set. Another data set is University of California, Irvine. That's machine learning repository. It's one of the oldest repositories, and many of the journal articles that use some kind of novel data sets, they also have data uploaded to this repository. So it means that you can use any types of data available in this repository. You can have a sorting, like what kind of tasks that you want to solve, number of, for example, of instances, number of attributes, and so on. So if you want to play a little bit with the data, please feel free to visit this repository. They have a dedicated web page for each of the data sets, like data itself in the data folder and data set description. So this data set, as you can see, has 63 million of samples. So that's a huge data set. And, all types of problems, like there was even a data set on wine quality, I think something related to car manufacturers, some particles, from astronomy, so like all domains that you can possibly think of. Now, features, attributes, characteristics, so technically it's the same thing. In some of the cases, you'll read attributes in machine learning literature. In most cases, in this course, we are going to use features. So features is like a variable. As I mentioned before, it's something that describes certain characteristic. Like, assume we have a wood classification problem that we want to classify three different types of wood, like ash, pine, birch. And then for this, we want to use only two attributes. So something that is called overall brightness and also wood grain prominence, right? So for this problem, first of all, we need to think how we collect this information, how we collect the features, measure the features. Then we do the supervised learning. So I'm going to talk about differences about between supervised and supervised learning later. But normally, it's something where we have the labels. So these will be our labels. And then we train the model. As I mentioned, we have a certain algorithm that we want to use for this task. And then we have also features and output labels or the classes. So if we have chosen these attributes correctly, so the example that I mentioned before, classification between cats and dogs, if you choose two attributes like number of ears and number of eyes, most likely you will fail because the features will be the same for all animals. There won't be any change. In this case, you can clearly see that, for example, the density, the brightness and grain prominence will be different. So it means that our hypothesis about feature selection was correct. So it means that we actually can use it to classify. So it means that if we can clearly see that, you know, for each of the class we have a separate cluster or separate region on the visualization on the picture, then we have chosen correctly. If we have everything, you know, just displayed in some kind of like one distribution, like one normal distribution, but it's the same plot, we don't see any difference, then we didn't choose right features. Now, speaking about the data, there are three types of data, I mean both features and classification labels, that you normally will see in the literature. That's the toy data, like iris flower data set. For simple tasks, this is like a benchmark for most of the machine learning methods. If you want to test that your method works, you download the iris flower data set that has four features and three classes, and then you test. If you get something like 95% accuracy for your model, then it's good. So 95%, for example, plus minus. If you get 18% accuracy, then the model doesn't work. So it's something wrong with the data. Sorry, not the data, but the model itself. Now, synthetic data in some of the applications, like, for example, financial crimes, we cannot really get real data from banks. So it means that we need to simulate the data, and that's called a synthetic data, or simulated data. And the last example is the data from your application domain, like computer viruses. That's real data. So if you want to do some research or analysis of computer viruses, you go to, for example, VirusShare. You download all the computer virus samples, and then you analyze them. So machine learning model, this is a ready-to-use tool that you can deploy. Like, for example, if you're interested in deep learning, deep neural networks, there are a lot of trained models that are available that can be used. Like, for example, a tool that everyone knows, ChatGPT, right? So that's a ready-to-use trained model that you just kind of utilize to just communicate with this model. A previous one was GPT-2. That's a trained machine learning or neural network that can actually be used for natural language processing. And I think at some point they have like 1.5 million of parameters in this model. So it's a huge model that you can download to your computer. You can use Python and you can actually play it with this model yourself. So that's a trained, fitted model to, for example, English language. They also have a bit smaller model for Norwegian language. So if you want to test, you just can try to play a little bit with this model. So model fitting in general, independently from the complexity of our machine learning algorithm, independently from the size of data, it's usually a kind of knowledge representation. So as I mentioned, it can have 100 gigabytes of text that will be summarized in perhaps 1 megabyte neural network model, so 1 megabyte of parameters. So that's kind of a compression or model fitting. How many of you know what is regression? All right, so regression is something that is used heavily in things like weather prediction, right? So if you go to year.no, you most likely will see that the temperature has been like this until now, and then in the next 48 hours, it will be changing. So that's a regression. It's a prediction based on the previous information using a simple one or two values of the feature. Like in this case, you can see it's a simple example. So we have a function that you can recognize, right? And then we want to synthesize the data. So in this case, we want to create some kind of real-world data by adding some noise. So we want to to add some kind of randomness in this function in order to have it not that idle. So that won't be 100% representation of our function. Oops, that was too early. So in overall, just one of the types of machine learning methods called regression. But in overall, when we dealing with regression, we have two variables. So the variable that changes, for example, over time, and also the magnitude. So we have some kind of like in this case x. So observation, and then we have t that represents the value of the variable, like y, for example, that is changing based on the input x. So the same way as dependent-independent variable. And our goal is to see if we can actually build a model that represents our data. So our data is not our function. Not the green one, but our data is more like a real-world synthesized data. And let's assume we have 10 points. We generated 10 points. That's our synthetic data. They are distributed in the range between 0 and 1. They generated from this function, and we added some noise. So normally, when we want to model the data, we need to have some kind of model description. So the simplest one is the polynomial curve. So this is our y, which consists of multiple, functions. So it can be either constant, if we have only W0, so we don't have any x. Can be linear, quadratic, and so on. So it depends on the degree of polynomial that we want to put it in this model. The higher degree of the polynomial may result in a very nice model that represents our initial data, but it also may result in a model that is not applicable in real world. So it depends on the parameters that we're using. So these are normally called linear models. So our task is to see whether having a more complex model will actually benefit. Like if you're going to look into GPT-2, they have 3 or 4 models that you can import in your program if you're writing in Python. Like the smallest one, I think, is 300 millions of attributes, and then 1,500 million of attributes as the largest model. So it depends on the model. Sometimes you get a very nice accuracy if you use the most complex model that you can. But it also implies that you know, the complexity will be higher, the speed of the model will be lower, you'll need more memory, and you'll need more time to use this model. Right, so the task is very simple. We have the data, we have the model, theoretical model. Now that, the only thing that is left is to find the weights. So we need a right set of weights to kind of represent these changes in the input data. I suggest we take a 10-minute break so that you can refill the coffee, and then we start again at 13:10. All right, welcome back. So we're talking about the polynomial curve fitting, and that we have our synthetic data that we want to map to a certain model. And that's our model that we want to utilize. So the only thing is that is missing is our weights or our model parameters. Right, so all these W0, W1, W2, and so on, they are missing. So the way how we can, let's say, estimate what's the difference between our ideal polynomial curve. So as I mentioned, it can be constant, it can be line, it can be quadratic, it can be third degree, fourth degree, and so on. So the only way to get feeling like how far our data from this line is to utilize so-called sum of squares. So it's sum of square error. So basically, that's our function, ideal function that we used, we defined on this slide, and then our synthetic data. And we're going to use it as a squared component in overall evaluation. So in order to find E, the value of E, we need to perform, let's say, linear combination of squared components, so the squared differences between ideal line Y and also our actual synthetic data T. And then we'll give it will give us some kind of understanding. So if it's zero, it means that, you know, it's a perfect fit. Like we don't need to train anything. That's it fits, for example, a line. If it's some kind of big value, then it means that the model does not fit the data well. There are also different types of measurements that we can use. Like for example, mean square error can be least mean square error. Statistical measurements like variance kurtosis, and from the information theory, it's mutual information and information entropy. So that was there was a nice question in the break about, let's say, information entropy. So we're going to talk about information theory and how it's expressed in bits, so bits of information a bit later. But that's also a way to express the uncertainty and errors. So these objective functions, I mean, if you look at the objective function and, for example, if we have, let's say, control over W, for us it means that we can actually try to reduce the error, right? So we can try to reduce this difference so that our ideal line or the model will follow closely these particular data, synthetic data. So that's the flexibility that we get. So these objective functions that we can utilize, as you can see here, is sum of squares, right? The difference, mean square error. So that's a little bit different when we calculate a mean of a particular point, data point. And then it also can be a variance from the mean, from the overall mean. So as I mentioned, if you want to get the ideal model of the data of our synthetic data, we need first of all to select what kind of polynomial we'd like to use, like degree 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then we need to adjust W so that it has the least possible error in the end, or sum of square errors in the end. So you can see why it's called sum of squares error. So that's our square. That's the error, so the difference between the ideal function and our synthetic data, and that's our sum. So that's a very simple representation. So in order to optimize this function, we of course need to use partial derivative. So how many of you know what is partial derivative? So you can read a little bit more also in Kononenka. That's the way how to optimize functions, right? Let's assume we want to optimize a function which is something like, let's assume it's yx, y equal to x to the power 2. So what's the derivative of x to the power 2? so like 2x. And then this information is used to find a minima. So we can technically find a derivative, 2x, and then the place where it's equal to 0, so extreme point, it will be 0. So that's the way how we find, how we optimize the function, and how the optimization works in overall in machine learning methods. Like, for example, when it comes to neural network, it's all based on the gradient descent training where the partial derivatives are used. So the model complexity drives the data requirement. So if we have very little data, it doesn't make sense to have a very complex model, even though it may yield good results. So sometimes you need to see what's the complexity of the model and what's the complexity and let's say quality of the data. So now I'm going to show you examples of a polynomial of different degrees of polynomial. Like, for example, if we have y equal to just W0, so that's a constant, right? So we can just adjust the kind of placement of this constant. And our real-world data, synthetic data, is here. So, of course, you can see that, you know, the difference between these points and every, let's say, at every point and our line or constant will be tremendous. So that's not optimal. I mean, it does not follow the sinusoid form. Now we can have the first order polynomial approximation. So that will be W0 plus something like 2W1, right? And, W1X. So that's already a line that we can kind of like rotate. We can also raise it or lower it, and then we can adjust. So at this point, you can see that the difference between these points and the line will be actually not that big, right? So it's much better than the previous example when we used only a constant line. Now let's move on to the third-order polynomial function, which is a cubic function. Surprisingly, you can see that it fits extremely well, right? So we have a very, very little difference or square errors here. So there will be a very, very small. So in the end, actually, we get a very good result. So we can say that, you know, it's good enough. It covers 90% of the accuracy of the synthetic data, and we can stop. If we don't want to stop, we move on to the ninth order polynomial function, which, as you can see, yields even more error than it was originally it yields error on every region which is not our synthetic data. So as you can see from the picture, the function goes through all points of synthetic data. It means that we have a very good match, so a zero error. So we can say that, you know, the error in this case will be zero. But obviously you can see that something is wrong here, right? The function does not fit to all data points in between. So that won't be a good fit, and in the end we'll just get a very, very big error that we cannot really utilize in a real-world case. So again, the main condition is that we need to understand what's the, let's say, best M in this case, and then test also the performance, test like how good it can fit our synthetic data. So every time we need to evaluate the performance. So for the performance metric, we can also use residual mean square calculation. So that's typically a calculation of what's the error for each kind of average error for each of the component for each of the point. Now, speaking about training and testing, You'll see it later, especially when it comes to Python libraries, you know, practice when it comes to Weka, RapidMiner. In most of the cases, you will be asked to provide first training data and testing data. So from the name, already you can see that, you know, there are differences and the purpose is different. So normally we use most of the data for training purpose, and some of the data is being held. So once model is trained, we can evaluate this model on previously unseen data, which is called test data. So we test it, how good is the performance. So in this case, we can actually have a generalization of the performance. So like, you know, if the model can recognize the same patterns that is in the data set, but they're not exactly the same, they're similar, and the model can perform, you know, it can understand, can, you know, recognize, then it means that it's a good model. So we have a good performance. If we plot the root mean square errors for the training and for the testing, you can see that it's kind of two distinct plots. Like, we have different types of M. So for the training data, we have M, which is a kind of high. So that's our E, error. And then it goes down to zero. So if you remember the plot where our red polynomial line goes through all blue points, this is our best training fit. It goes through all data. It approximates well. For the test data, we can see the same. But as I mentioned, that if we have some data that the model hasn't seen before, and we try to evaluate our model with M equal to 9, so instead of these points, we'll get these points. So it means that, you know, it does not work. We cannot really utilize this model in our tasks. So that's overfitting. So it means that, you know, we kind of were in a good area here, but then this one is not working. It will be too much error. This model will not be practical. We cannot really apply it in real-world scenarios. So we have a few regions here, as I mentioned. First of all, that's the region where we get a poor performance due to a very simple, very trivial model. So it means that if we have just a constant line a linear model, then it doesn't really work. So another extreme point is where we have a best performance on training set, but on testing it performs extremely poor. So that's overtrained or fitted. So we call it overfitting. And this area in the middle is the best trade-off between the complexity. So we still can use, for example, M equal to 3 and have a good performance. And then we can use, for example, M equal to 5, 6, 7. So still it will be reasonably good performance. Right, so for us, the whole idea is to select a number of M polynom and then find the optimal W. So this is being solved through partial derivatives. So I'm going to explain it in the next sessions where we have any types of optimization. And that's basically looking for extreme points using partial derivatives, minima and maximum. So just to give you a feeling what kind of coefficients we are getting after the training is done, after these partial derivatives are extracted, and then we found our best set of weights W. So that's, let's say, our optimal set of weights W. Then we can see that for the constant line, it will be just 0.19, so it's not a huge magnitude of the coefficient. It doesn't look like overwhelmingly huge. So for the line, it's 0.82 and minus 1.27. So our model here will be 0.82 minus 1.27x x1. So for M3 it's getting bigger, but then what you can see for M9, the coefficients became extremely big, even though our error here on the training data or synthetic data will be zero because it fits well. The magnitude of these coefficients will be huge. And this is a direct explanation why on the testing data, when we like to test our new data, previously unseen data, the model will become crazy. You know, it will just shoot like through the skies with the values. So at some point we might get like 1 million instead of zero, something like this. So that's also where we have a challenge with the data. So if we want to increase the quality of the coefficients, if we want to increase the quality of the model, we need to get more data, right? So let's assume we have, for example, different types of data points, right? So we generated more points, and then we try to increase them from N10 to 15 to 100. So here, when we have more points, even though the model is quite complex, M equal to 9, still, in most cases, it will follow our ideal data and also synthetic data. So that's a thing to remember. So the more data we have, the better. But also, we need to have the data that represents our let's say, process, real-world process, as close as possible. So how do... What are the, let's say, ways to solve this problem when we have too little data and the coefficients are huge? So it means that the model is overfitted. One of the solutions is so-called regularization. So you can read on your own what's regularization, but that's a common approach in things like, for example, support vector machine, SVM, that we're going to use. It's just adding one additional component to the error function so that we can kind of dump, we can adjust a little bit the complexity of our coefficients, because in real case, we won't be able to apply non-regularized model because it will be way too complex. So in this case, we have the goodness of fit. So that's our sum of squared errors that we're considering as an error function. That, of course, under normal circumstances, without regularization, will give us a huge values of error. And then we have another one is the model complexity term. So in order to reduce the model complexity, we can also introduce this additional term. I'm not going to go into details how to calculate it, but that's just a common approach that is used. It's also quadratic optimization that is going to be used to calculate this term. But the whole idea is to find a regularizer. Like, for example, if we have no term added, that's our original overfitted function that we cannot really use, right? So in order to make it a little bit more realistic, we can either go like to a huge regularizer, right? So it will be either like overkill, it will be too simplistic model, like nearly a constant line, or maybe just a linear model. Or we can find something that is optimal. So this is optimization problem. But it also will give us a new function that fits actually well this data, even though it's originally overfitted. Right, so please remember what's the regularization. We're going to use it the same way in support vector machine, so I'm going to talk later. It's in the context of classification. And now if we want to add, so these are our new coefficients, W. If we want to adjust them according to the this complexity term or regularization or regularizer, then we can see that when it's optimal, the magnitude of all the coefficients will be somewhat reasonable, right? So it will give us, let's say, something that we can actually apply in real-world scenario, like this model represented by a red line. So it will be something that we can actually use, even though the original model is overfitted. So the solution to this particular problem, first one, we need to get more data, 10 times more data, good quality data, or we introduce regularizer that adjusts and kind of removes this error to negligible, let's say, magnitude. So that's the whole idea. Right? So then you can see, you know, that actually when it comes to data, let's say coefficients or to model coefficients, it's very much comparable to the normal model, non-regularized, with the M3. So that's our cubic function. So that's why you kind of can balance the complexity of the model, overfitting of the model, amount of data, and also whether it will be overfitted or not. So in general, what we can see that, for example, this is our lambda that controls the complexity of the model versus amount of data versus error. So it kind of helps us to get to the point where, you know, it's rather optimal, and it gives us a very good model on training and later on testing. Now, performance evaluation. So as you've seen already, one of the performance evaluators is error squares, so sum of square errors, or different types of residual squares errors. So it's at least 10 different types. Also, they sometimes use percentage. That's used very much in regression. In classification, we're going to talk later today. That's more if we can classify like cat and a dog. If we say that, you know, a model says cat to a cat and dog to a dog, then it's 100% accuracy. So it works properly. So for the simplistic or simple classification, we are going to use logistical regression. So it's very simple, just 0, 1. So we need to train the model that will give us just 1 or 0, depending on the input data. So if we have just two classes, like in this case, 0, 1, or we also call them as false, true. The classification evaluation or performance evaluation is done using the confusion matrix. So confusion matrix, you will hear a lot in this course. That's the metric that represents, in simple terms, how many samples we classified correctly and how many samples we classified incorrectly. So let's assume we have our cat, dog. So this one will be, it's also called true positive, and this number represents a number of cats that our machine learning classified as cats. And true negatives, so as I mentioned, the other class is usually called false or negative class, it's the terminology. That will be a number of dogs classified as dogs, right? So if we have a best machine learning model, then we'll be, let's say, 100%, 0, 0, 100%. So all cats and dogs were classified correctly. That's not the case in real-world data. You'll see a lot that you can't get, you know, 100% in true positives and 100% in true negatives. So you rather will get like 10 here, 10 here, maybe 90 here and 90 here. So the overall accuracy of this model will be 90%. a real world example. Like, for example, if we have a prediction model that can identify how many customers buy computers and how many actually bought computers based on some like statistics, based on some surveys, then our true positive and true negatives will be these numbers. So in good models, if your model is good, it performs well, the data is well. So this model, this number will be much bigger than these two numbers, and the same vice versa for the true negatives. And that's the overall number of data points in our data set. So having this evaluation, you can see that, you know, if one of the classes is imbalanced, like in this case, number of customers that let's say bought computers, a number of customers that didn't buy computers is like two times different. So that's not a lot. So we shouldn't worry too much. Now, the overall evaluation when it comes to binary classification, sometimes to multi-class classification, is overall classification accuracy. So the accuracy in percent, normally, like how many cats and dogs were classified properly. So let's say it's 90%, it's a relatively good machine learning model. Sometimes we also use error rate. So this is 1 minus accuracy. So if we have accuracy equal to, let's say, 90%, which is also 0.9, we can use without percent. That's the same, essentially. Then the error rate here will be like 0.1, right, or 10%. So that's the representation. When you will be analyzing the data for your assignments, you also can explain that, for example, the classification was like 90%, and some of the samples were misclassified because of some error, for example. We also have different types of additional metrics, at least maybe 4, 5, 6 that you'll see in this course, like sensitivity. That's a number of true positive divided by all number of positive. So in this case, like number of correctly classified cats divided by number of cats in overall. So we have specificity, the same way. True negative divided by negatives, number of correctly classified dogs divided by number of dogs. So class imbalance problem, you'll see also in this course a few times. So as I mentioned like a few slides before, if we have, you know, numbers like this, it's just a few times difference. It's not a big class imbalance. It's more dramatic for any types of machine learning models if you have one class like 10,000 and another class is 10. So that's a huge imbalance. So we can't really build a good classification model if we have such big difference in the number of samples for each classes. So it means that here we have a difference in 1,000 times. So that's too much. None of the classifiers will work. So we also will see how we can solve this problem. We can actually use sampling, like in Weka, to increase it, for example, to 1,000. So that's a sampling mechanism that just generates new data points using the distribution from the original class C2. Right, so another metrics that we also will see is precision, so exactness. So the number of data points that the classifier label as positive and that are actually positive. And recall, so like number of positive data points that the classified label as positive. So it can be a little bit confusing, but later you will kind of get a feeling what's the difference. Also, if you're using Weka, by default, the results of Weka includes all the true positive, false positive, and the confusion matrix, plus they have accuracy in percent, like number of correctly classified instances, and so on. So the example of, let's say, class imbalance is demonstrated in this table. So we have actual class like cancer. It's only 90 patients. And the number of patients that didn't have cancer is 9,560. So you already can have a feeling that, you know, it's like how many? 100 times difference, right? So that's like 1% to 100%. So that's a big class imbalance. Now, our accuracy is 96.4%, which is good. I mean, if we have accuracy more than 90, we can consider, or 95, we can consider as the classifier performs well. Now, then we can also see what's the sensitivity, right? So number of patients that had cancer, a number of patients that were classified as they didn't have cancer, right? So you can see that by using these types of metrics, additional metrics, we can spot this irregularity, that actually this is a very bad example. And the same way, like number of patients that had cancer to overall number of number of patients that were detected with cancer and number of patients that had cancer is only 39%. So it's not good. It's actually a very bad classification model. So that's the example of class imbalance. You need to spot this problem. If you see that your data has class imbalance, then most likely you need to do something with that. A classical example of class imbalance in cybersecurity is the attacks, right? Network attacks. So in most of the cases, like 99% of the traffic is legitimate, is benign traffic. But then you'll get maybe 1, 2, 3, 5% of attack traffic. So it means that if you try to build some kind of classification model, most likely this model will not be accurate. So you need to generate more attack traffic and then do something with that. One of the famous data set is KDD CAP99. It's a synthetic data set, so it was produced by DARPA in the US in 1998, and then it was transferred to the challenge, like knowledge discovery competition in 99, and then the way how they generated attacks and normal traffic, that was not that imbalanced. So there was kind of more machine learning friendly data distribution. We're going to also use a tool called, or approach called cross-validation. So as I mentioned earlier, testing and training is when you first take one part of the data set and you test it. You train the model. And then you take the other part of the data set and test it, so they're kind of independent. So cross-validation is when you do this process 10 times, but you always use different chunks of data. And for this, of course, we need a little bit more time. So it's randomly partitioned, mutually exclusive subsets of data. It's also called leave one out. So all these types of methods are designed to help us to evaluate independently what's the classification accuracy. So in one case, you might get, at first run, for example, for D1, you get like 70% accuracy. D2, you get 90% accuracy. D3, you get 80% accuracy. Right, because it's selected randomly, and there was different property in the data. But naturally, we can say that an average accuracy in this case is 80%. One of the last things that I'd like to mention is receiver operator curve. So that's that's the kind of the trade-off between sensitivity and specificity. So if you build and you see that your curve, the trade-off between sensitivity and specificity is like that, then that's a very bad classifier, so you can't really use it. If you see something that follows this pattern, then it's the best classifier, so it's like 100%. So the rule of thumb, if you can see that, you know, this line is close to 45 degrees diagonal line, then it's bad classifier. If it's close to the these two lines, then it's a good classifier. So that's the rule of thumb. And the last thing is a multi-class classification problem. So before this slide, we talked about binary classification, two classes. Like it can be called 0-1 or labeled. It can be labeled as true-false. It can be labeled as negative or positive and negative. Now, completely different story when we have several classes, like four classes. So that's called a multi-class classification problem. We also can build a confusion matrix. And actually, it's way more representative when it comes to multi-class classification problem, because you already can spot some outliers or some inconsistencies for, you know, some of the classes. And then the accuracy in this case, the overall accuracy, may not be that representative. Like before, because for one of the class, you might get, for example, 70% accuracy. For other class, you get 10% accuracy. For third class, 20% accuracy, and then 30% accuracy, right? So having the overall accuracy won't be representative. So if you say that the average accuracy is, I don't know, like 35%, that won't be very much representative, right? Because you obviously have some problems with these classes, but you have one class that performs well. So that's why in VECA, they usually build a confusion metric that represents all this type of data. And the last thing is course of dimensionality. We're going to talk also about course of dimensionality later when it comes to feature selection. But the whole idea is that if you have more dimensions of the data, then the complexity, like storage and processing complexity, will grow. So if you have one data set that has five variables, five features, and another data set that has maybe 100 features, then it's better to choose data set with lower number of features, because you can't really have the same speed, right? Because it's, first of all, you need to store this data in the memory. Second, you need to process the data. So most likely you'll get a considerable degradation in performance. Right. Thank you for your attention. Any questions? Anything that is not clear? Let's see if we have on Zoom. Nothing on Zoom. So if you have any questions, you can always ping me on email. Just ask me or Kyle, and we'll be able to help you. And yes, good luck with the exercise. And thank you for attending today. So I'm also going to end up Zoom session. So we are done for today.